Good afternoon and welcome to this briefing on today's monetary policy decision. My name is Judy Hitchin and I'm Head of Communications at the Reserve Bank of Australia. The plan today is to begin with remarks by the Governor, Philip Lowe, and then answer questions from participants. At the conclusion of the remarks, I'll provide directions on how to participate in the Q&A session. If everybody could keep themselves on mute, that means we won't have that many distracting sounds. I'd now like to hand the proceedings over to Governor Philip Lowe. Thank you.
Good afternoon and thank you for joining this webinar. As you know, the Reserve Bank Board met this morning. At our meeting, we agreed to first maintain the target for the cash rate at 10 basis points. Second, continue to purchase government bonds at the rate of $4 billion a week until February next year, with a further review to be undertaken then. And third, we decided to discontinue the target for the yield on the April 2024 bond. I'd like to take this opportunity to explain these decisions, particularly the decision to discontinue the yield target, and I want to also answer your questions. I'll start off with some background and our updated forecasts. The Australian economy is now growing again after the recovery from the pandemic was interrupted by the Delta outbreak. GDP is expected to record a solid gain in the December quarter, following the sharp contraction in the September quarter. And by the middle of next year, GDP is expected to be back on its pre-Delta path. Our central scenario is for the economy to grow by around 5.5% over 2022 and by around 2.5% over 2023. At the outset of the pandemic, economic policy, including monetary policy, set out to build a bridge to the other side. The good news is that other side is now clearly in sight. As restrictions are eased, spending is expected to pick up relatively quickly as people seek a return to a more normal way of life. The rapid increase in vaccination rates has been critical in getting us to this point. More broadly, though, the support provided by both monetary and fiscal policy means that the Australian economy is well placed to resume its expansion. Resilience of the economy continues to be evident in the labour market. A strong bounce back in hours work is now underway after a sharp fall during the lockdowns. The unemployment rate's expected to trend lower over the next couple of years. Our central scenario is for the unemployment rate to reach 4.25% by the end of next year and 4% by the end of 23. This would be a very welcome development. Australia has not experienced a sustained period of unemployment at levels this low since the early 1970s. Inflation in underlying terms remains low in Australia at just 2.1%. It is, however, a little higher than it has been over recent years. This increase largely reflects higher oil prices in global markets, higher prices for residential construction, and strained global supply chains. Looking forward, we're expecting a further but only gradual increase in underlying inflation. Our central forecast is for underlying inflation of 2.25% in 22 and 2.5% in 2023. While these forecasts for inflation are higher than our previous forecasts, we are not expecting the surge in inflation that's been experienced in some other countries. The situation in Australia is quite different. We have not seen the same fall in labour force participation as experienced elsewhere, and the impact of other supply disruptions, including in energy markets, is less evident in the Australian CPI. It's also relevant that the starting point for inflation and wages growth are lower in Australia than in many other countries. In addition, our business liaison suggests that wage growth remains modest, although there are clearly some hotspots. Wage growth is expected to pick up as the labour market tightens, but this pickup is expected to be only gradual. So that is the economic backdrop against which today's decisions were made. I'd now like to turn to the yield target. The yield target was introduced in the exceptional days of March 2020. It was part of a package of monetary policy measures designed to help build that bridge to the other side that I spoke about before. That package has been effective, and it is one of the reasons that the Australian economy is now well placed to recover from the pandemic. The yield target had two motivations. The first was to directly anchor the short end of the yield curve so that funding costs were low across the economy. In the exceptional circumstances of the time, we judged that the most efficient way of anchoring the curve was to target a risk-free yield further out along the yield curve than the cash rate. second motivation was to reinforce the board's forward guidance that the cash rate was very unlikely to be increased for 3 years, which at the time ran until March 23. On both counts, the yield target has been effective and it has supported the recovery of the Australian economy. But its effectiveness as a monetary policy tool declined as expectations about future interest rates shifted due to the run of data and the forecast progress towards our goals. At the time the target was introduced, the board assigned a very low probability to an increase in the cash rate over the 3-year horizon of the target, which at the time aligned with the maturity date of the April 23 bond. Indeed, the central scenario was that the cash rate would need to be held steady beyond that date, and the likelihood of an earlier increase in the cash rate was considered to be very low. Today, more than a year and a half on, the balance of probabilities is a little different. Having said that, given our forecasts, it's still entirely plausible that the first increase in the cash rate will not be before the maturity of the current target bond, that is the bond with a maturity date of April 24. But it is now also plausible that a lift in the cash rate could be appropriate in 2023. In our central scenario, underlying inflation reaches the midpoint of the 2-3% target range only in late 23. Having underlying inflation reach the midpoint of the target range for the first time in 7 years does not, by itself, warrant an increase in the cash rate. It's also relevant that wages growth at the end of 23 is expected to be running at just 3%. While this is higher than it is now, it is still below the average over the decade, two decades to 2015. This expected configuration of inflation and wages growth allows the board to be patient in considering a lift in interest rates. It's also possible that the global inflation shock is more persistent than currently expected and that this is transmitted to Australia. There's also uncertainty as to how wages growth responds to the unemployment rate being near 4% for an extended period. We've little historical experience to guide us here. And there's also the question of the impact on labour supply of the opening up of the international border. Given this, it is possible that faster than expected progress continues to be made towards achieving the inflation target. The recovery of the economy and the recent inflation data have increased the probability of this. If this faster progress were to be sustained, there would be a case to lift the cash rate before 2024. It is, of course, also possible that we experience yet another setback that throws the economy off course and delays progress towards our goals. One source of such a shock would be a new strain of the virus or a decline in vaccine effectiveness. In this case, the cash rate would need to remain at its current level for longer than otherwise. At its meeting this morning, the board considered these various possibilities and their implications for the yield target. One option discussed was to continue with the target on the basis that it remained consistent with our central forecast for the economy. A second option we considered was to lift the target yield or to change the maturity of the target bond. However, this would not have been consistent with the board's view that the yield target was an appropriate tool during an exceptional period, but it was not a tool to be used on an ongoing basis. The third option considered was to discontinue the target on the basis of the shift in the distribution of possible outcomes for the cash rate that I just spoke about. And as you would know, the board decided on this third option. I want to make it clear that this decision does not reflect a view that the cash rate will be increased before 2024. As I've discussed, there is genuine uncertainty as to the timing of future adjustments in the cash rate. Given the information we currently have to hand, it's still entirely possible that the cash rate will remain at its current level until 2024. But it's also possible that an earlier move will be appropriate. Given this, the board judged that there were more costs than benefits in seeking to anchor the yield on the April 2024 bond at 10 basis points. Given the progress towards our goals and the revised outlook, the board judged that it was no longer sustainable to maintain the target of 10 basis points. The board took into account the fact that the shift in the distribution of possible outcomes was already being reflected in other term interest rates in Australia. If we had sought to pin the yield on the April 24 bond at 10 basis points in the face of these developments, we would have ended up holding all the freely tradable bonds in that bond line so that trading in that bond would cease. And this would have further diminished the usefulness of the target. I recognise that the past few days have been turbulent ones in the bond market. Our decision to stand out of the market in the days between the release of the CPI and the board meeting did result in uncertainty as to our policy, and it affected market pricing and liquidity. We faced a difficult choice over those days. Stand out of the market until the board had the opportunity to review the latest data and forecasts in a matter of just a few days, or enter a thin market in an effort to defend a target that was losing credibility for the reasons I've spoken about. I thought the better approach was for the board to review the situation and decide whether or not to confirm or to discontinue the target. And as you know, we decided to discontinue the target. I'd now like to turn to a broader point, and that is the nature of the RBA's forward guidance. As I've stressed on previous occasions, our forward guidance is based on the state of the economy, not the calendar. Our focus has been on returning inflation sustainably to the 2 to 3% range, doing what we reasonably can to reach full employment. These are our goals, and it is progress on these goals that will continue to determine decisions about the cash rate. These decisions are not driven by the calendar. We have, though, supplemented this state-based guidance with a reference to our forecasts and the calendar. We've done this to provide the community with our expected timeframe and the factors that will influence that timeframe. This in no way has constituted a promise that the cash rate would remain unchanged to any particular date. Rather, at the time of each policy statement, we provided our best expectation of the timing of when the cash rate might change, recognising the expected timing can change. Well, on the issue of timing, the latest data and forecasts do not warrant an increase in the cash rate in 2022. I recognise that some other central banks are raising rates, but our situation is different. The board will not increase the cash rate until inflation is sustainably in the target range. We are prepared to look through spikes in the inflation rate, as we have done with headline CPI inflation this year. For inflation to be sustainably in the target range, wages growth will have to be materially higher than it is now. This is likely to take time, and the board is prepared to be patient. Finally, in terms of the bond purchase program, we'll be including the April 24 bond in our regular auctions from next week. We'll also continue with the program at the current rate of purchases until February, when we will review again. That review will be based on the same three considerations as previous reviews. They are the actions of other central banks, how our bond market is functioning, and most importantly, the actual and expected progress towards our goals for inflation and unemployment. Again, thank you for joining the webinar, and I'm here to answer your questions. Over to you, Judy.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us. For the Q&A session, if you have a question to ask, I would ask that you do it with your cameras on, if possible. And if you'd like to ask a question, please raise your virtual hand. I'll then call on you each in turn to ask a question, at which time you'll need to unmute yourself. We'll allow for one follow-up question for each. And then after you finish, if you can mute your line again, that would be great. Please do not post questions in the chat, as we're not monitoring the chat line at this time. So the first question is from Patrick Commons from The Australian. Over to you, Patrick.
Thanks very much, Judy, and thank you, Governor. Look, can you describe a possible scenario in which inflation is within the target range and sustainably within that target range without wages growth being at around the 3% or more mark?
We're in the world of hypotheticals here, but Sure. From first principles, if there was very, very little productivity growth in Australia, let's say productivity growth was zero, then inflation at 2.5% would go with wages growth at 2.5%. No growth in real wages. I'm optimistic that the country can deliver ongoing productivity growth, and we're factoring in at least 1% productivity growth. So if we can deliver 1% productivity growth and we have 2.5% inflation, then on average wages should be increasing at 3.5%. But if we don't have productivity growth, then nominal wage growth that goes with any given rate of inflation is lower. I think it really points to the need for the country to again refocus on the productivity agenda, because that will allow us to have faster wages growth. So that's
okay, and
I can imagine. Yeah. Judy?
Okay. The next question we have is from Ron Meisen from the Fin Review. Ron, if you'd like to ask your question.
G'day, Governor. Sorry, camera's not working, but thank you for the press conference today. A little earlier this year, you said that the expectations around rate hikes later in 2022 were difficult to reconcile with the picture that you were painting of the economy. What do you make of rate rises being priced in, you know, as early as sort of February, March next year?
I think that's a complete overreaction to the recent inflation data. Said the test that we've set is inflation sustainably within the 2 to 3% range, which means inflation's got to be more than just 2.1 or 2.2% for a couple of quarters. We've got to see inflation up around the midpoint of the target range and be confident that it's going to stay there. I'm not sure what state of the world is that would, or how we would get to that state of the world, you know, and be in a position to raise rates early in the new year. It seems a long way from where we are now, and it's not consistent with our reaction function. So I still struggle with the scenario in which rates need to be raised next year. Things would have to turn out very, very differently than what we currently expect. The factors that have kept wages growth in Australia low for a decade would have to reverse, and inflation would have to jump up. Not impossible, but I would say it's extremely unlikely.
Ron, do you have a follow-up question, or is that it?
No, that's great. Thanks, Judy.
Great. The next question we have is from Richard Yetsenga. If you could ask your question, Richard.
Hi, thank you. Thanks, Governor, for those comments. The economy has surprised, the activity side of the economy has surprised the bank and many forecasters over the past year. Upstream inflation indicators and inflation expectations have surprised many forecasters over the past year. And you've adjusted your view for those, but still seem to have the next link in the chain kind of unchanged, which is that the shift from those indicators through the wage structure is going to be very slow and gradual. It doesn't seem like anything else about this cycle has been slow and gradual. What's the prospect you get maybe pleasantly surprised on that side as well?
Well, we have upgraded both our inflation and wage forecasts. I mean, the inflation forecast for the current year has been revised up 0.5%. So we originally, or back 3-6 months ago, we were seeing upside surprises on the economy. That was in turn reflected in the forecasts. And just very recently, we saw an upside surprise on inflation, and that's now been incorporated into our forecasts. So whether there are further upside surprises, I think, will really depend on two factors. The first is the rate at which the disruptions to global supply chains are resolved. And I think it's quite plausible that over time, the demand for goods slows as people move back to services. And while that happens, the supply chain problems get resolved. So we could have fewer demand for goods, supply side problems get fixed up, and the price pressures in the global system come out. So that's an entirely plausible possibility. If that doesn't happen, then we'll see more foreign inflation coming into Australia. So that's one issue. And the second is what happens in the labour market. Now, the last time wage growth in Australia was above 3% was almost a decade ago. And we even had experience a few years ago where the unemployment rate in New South Wales and Victoria was 4 and 4.2%. Wage growth was sub 2. And we're seeing an experiment at the moment in Western Australia, effectively a closed economy and a very low unemployment rate, and their wage growth has picked up a bit, but it's still kind of modest. So our working hypothesis is that the factors that have been at play here are going to continue to be at play. They'll gradually wane as the labour market tightens. But to think the decade-long declining wages growth is going to be reversed in just a few months, so it's not in our... it's a long way from our central scenario that could happen. Things would have to change dramatically. I'm hoping that the wage growth picks up a bit more than we currently forecast, but the factors that have kept it down are pretty strong.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Chris Reed. Chris, if you could unmute yourself.
Hi there. Thanks, Governor. Look, my question's around the economic forecast. Could you just clarify, are the forecasts you've presented today, do they incorporate the current market pricing for cash rate hikes? And if that is the case, maybe could you just elaborate a bit on, you know, how the pretty substantial change we've seen since the previous forecast round has impacted on those forecasts? Thank you.
The forecasts were prepared a week ago before the kind of the big jump up in the OIS curve and interest rate expectations. So they do incorporate the market path a week or so ago. If we incorporate the current market path, it would make very little difference to the these forecasts, because the interest rate increases are back-ended in our forecast horizon. And there are, as we know, there are lags in the relationship between interest rates and activity, and the Phillips curve at the moment is very flat. So you've got to have a big shift in activity to cause the inflation forecast to change very much. So I think we're really talking kind of at the decimal point dimension if we were to change the interest rate forecasts or the interest rate assumptions in our forecast. So, part of the question, or that was, I don't know.
Very clear, thank you.
Yeah, so
great.
Back-ended and the lags in the system, it doesn't make that much difference to this particular set of numbers. It could make a big difference to 24 and 25, but we're not currently producing forecasts for those years. Thank you, Judy, back to you.
Great, the next question is from Tapper Strickland, if you could unmute yourself.
Thank you, Judy, and good afternoon, Governor Lowe. Just given that you have noted that it is now plausible that a lift in the cash rate could be appropriate in 2023 as opposed to 2024, does that imply the RBA has little tolerance for inflation being sustained higher than 2.5%? And I just wanted to get your feeling on your tolerance for inflation overshooting the target. Thank you.
Well, we want to get it to the midpoint of the target first. As I said in my prepared remarks, at the end of 23, we're expecting inflation to just get to 2.5 and wages growth just get to 3. In my view, that in and of itself does not justify higher interest rates. It could if the trajectory was onwards and upwards, but we're prepared to be patient. We want to see inflation get sustainably back to 2.5%, and we want to see the unemployment rate come down. That obviously runs some risk of inflation overshooting a little bit. And obviously that's a possibility, but we really want to make sure that we can deliver this 2.5% rate of inflation. And we're going to keep interest rates where they are till that happens. That does run some risk that inflation will be too high for a while, but it also runs risk that once again, inflation will be too low. And that's what's happened over the past decade. So there's uncertainty here. I don't know whether that's answered your question or whether you can follow up. Or
No, that has answered the question. Thank you, Governor Lowe.
Great. The next question is from Will Kalouris from CNBC. Will?
Thanks so much, Governor, for today. Just in terms of, I suppose, some of that uncertainty, there is obviously an expectation, I suppose, that we are going to see those rate hikes coming through. You're hoping to get that wages growth. But if you look at the timeline, it almost coincides with when we're expecting some significant migration to start to come back to Australia. So do you have concerns that perhaps we might not meet the wage target within that timeline? And if so, does that mean that you're going to maintain that firmness on your rate settings?
Well, if wage growth doesn't pick up and we have productivity growth, linking back to the very first question, then we'll be undershooting the midpoint of the inflation target and we won't be raising rates. I think the opening of the border is an interesting issue. It's going to have multiple effects. One is that people with skills in short supply will be able to come into the country, and we all know there are a lot of hotspots in the labour market at the moment, and that will help resolve some of those hotspots. On the other hand, there are many Australians who have been effectively locked down for a year or better part of a year who really want to travel overseas. Many young Australians are travelling overseas as part of what they do, as part of their work program and their career. And I think there's a big backlog of people who will want to do that. So there are going to be both pluses and minuses when we open the international border. And I think it's hard at this point to determine what the net effect of those will be on the labour market. I think in the short term, it will probably reduce the pressure in the hotspots. Whether it has broader effects beyond that, I'm not sure.
Great, thank you very much. The next question is from Shane Wright from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald.
G'day, Dr. Lowe. I just want to keep going back to wages growth. What confidence do you have that you can reach 3%? How important is the cash rate at 0.1 to getting to that 3%? And for those in the market who've priced in this rate increases through next year, what would a quarter or 50 basis point rate rise do to wages growth?
Just want to be kind of clear. We don't have a target for wages growth of 3%. Talking about wages growth of 3% was really in the context of the calculations I was articulating in response to the first question. If we're going to have 2.5% inflation and 1% labour productivity growth, then in the steady state, we need wage growth starting with a 3. So that's the configuration we're talking about. But if we have weak productivity growth, then obviously the wage numbers will be weaker than that. How confident are we going to get there? I think it does remain an open question. But our judgment is that if we can sustain an unemployment rate in the low 4s for a while, firms will have to compete more aggressively for labour. They'll be offering higher wage rates to attract workers, and they'll be giving their current workers a bigger pay rise. So there's uncertainty around that, though, because the last time we had the unemployment rates for a sustained period in the low 4s was in the early 70s. Very different economy then. It wasn't an open economy. It was very, it was closed and, a very different world. So we cannot be confident about how wages growth is going to respond to an extended period of low unemployment. But I'm have a reasonable degree of confidence that at 4%, firms will be competing more strongly for workers. And we already see this at the moment. The current rate of unemployment in the mid-4s, many firms are saying telling us that it's very hard to get workers. And their first response is to offer increased flexibility or bonuses or something to not embed in a higher cost structure, that kind of one-off things. So I think, and this will hopefully be tested, when we get the unemployment rate even lower, the short-term responses will have to translate into stronger wages growth. But rightly, there's uncertainty around that.
Great, thank you. The next question is from Peter Ryan from the ABC.
Yes, good afternoon, Governor. I was just wondering what, if any, discussion there was about housing in today's board meeting, given the continuing surging house prices, and whether any concern was registered and whether or not the Reserve Bank does see some role in part in trying to cool those prices.
Well, today's meeting, we didn't discuss housing in any detail. We'd had an extensive discussion at last meeting, and we had devoted our time today to discussing the yield targets. in the statement that was released at 2:30 said that the bank welcomes APRA's decision to increase the loan serviceability and buffer. That was a sensible thing to do in the current environment. The last part of your question was, is the Reserve Bank going to use effectively interest rates to contain housing prices? And as I've said before, that is not on our radar screen. It's not something we're contemplating. I don't think it would be appropriate. Certainly, a lift in interest rates now would take some of the steam out of the housing market, but it would also mean fewer people had jobs and wages growth would be even weaker than it currently is. That doesn't sound like a very good trade-off to me, and it's not one that we have a mandate to make, or even I think it's appropriate to make. It's more important that people have jobs and their wages are rising reasonably well. If the society is concerned about rising housing prices, I don't think the solution is higher interest rates. The solution is the structural things that have given us structurally higher level of housing prices, and that's the way we design our cities, the urban form, the tax incentives that are provided for investment in housing, where we choose to live, and the transportation networks. They're the things that, when you look across countries, they explain the variation in housing prices. So if it's a matter of public policy, it was considered important to address the level of housing prices, they're the things we should be looking at. I don't see higher interest rates as the solution to high housing prices, especially when higher interest rates come with fewer people in jobs and lower wages growth.
And if I could just take my follow-up there, through the Council of Financial Regulators, there's been some commentary about whether or not lending standards are remaining solid. Are you seeing any evidence at all, given the level of loans being given out and I guess the fear of missing out, that there could be some risks about lending standards?
At the moment, I don't have any concerns about the deterioration in lending standards. I think most of the lenders understand the risks in the macro environment and the lending standards are broadly appropriate. I do think that both lenders and borrowers need to be aware that interest rates will rise again. They're not going to rise again quickly. And as I said today, I think they're not going to rise next year. I think the most likely case is still 24, but it's possible that they go up in 23. So when people are making their borrowing decisions, they need to factor that into their calculations. And my hope is that the increase in the loan serviceability buffer reinforces that message that interest rates go up at some point and you need to be prepared for that. At the moment, I think banks understand that and I hope borrowers do as well.
The next question is from Ian Rogers from Banking Day. Over to Ian.
Good afternoon. Dr. Lowe, I was hoping you could unpack the supply chain considerations for us. Landed prices and producer prices are already taking off in select categories. Do you have much sense about when these dilemmas are going to resolve?
That's a good question. I wish I had a good sense. I think kind of it's useful to kind of step back and look at the big picture here. What we have seen during the pandemic is households right around the world switch from consuming services, because they couldn't, to consuming goods. And you know, we bought office equipment and home exercise equipment and stuff. So there's been very, very strong demand for goods globally and weak demand for services. Just at the same time that there was strong demand for goods, the ability of the global production system to produce goods was diminished because of factory shutdowns and COVID. So we've got strong demand for goods, impaired supply capacity. What do you think is going to happen to the prices? They go up. And that's exactly what we're seeing for commodity, good after good. And the strong demand for goods has also been reflected back into the markets for energy and materials, base metals and stuff. So the prices of those have gone up as well. I think the issue we're grappling with here is what does the situation over the next 6 months look like? I think it's eminently plausible that as economies open up, people will go back to consuming services, going to restaurants and traveling again, and buying fewer goods, buying fewer home exercise equipment and stuff for your house. So I think that rebalancing in consumption will take place. As that takes place, the supply chain problems are going to be progressively resolved as well. So it's quite possible, and this would be my base case, that in 6 months' time, these supply side problems look less troubling. And we'd see that in the global inflation numbers, and I hope less upward pressure on inflation here as well.
Thank you.
But there's a lot of uncertainty around that because it's you know, people talk about supply side issues. They're largely supply side issues because of strong demand. COVID affected production ability, but the bigger picture here is very, very strong for demand for goods around the world. And that pushes upward pressure on prices. I think that will normalise now as people go back to travelling and entertaining themselves. Judy, back to you.
Great. The next question is from Sophia Rodriguez from Central Banking Intel.
Good afternoon, Dr. Low. I've noticed that you have not, your unemployment rate forecasts are unchanged, but you have upgraded inflation and wage growth forecasts. So, which to me means that there are factors other than fall in the Phillips curve as a factor for rise in wage growth. So my question is, are you underestimating impact of high inflation on wage growth in terms of past inflation outcomes leading to higher wage growth, number one? And number two, is there also a possibility that you're a bit conservative on unemployment rate, on unemployment rate forecast, and if that falls faster, I mean, if that falls below 4%, we could see faster wage growth. So what are the other factors that could lead to upside in wage growth forecast?
Well, the scenarios you talk about, of course, they're both possible. I just don't think they're particularly likely. You've got to remember at the moment that underlying inflation in Australia is 2.1%. 2.1 after a number of years where it's been below zero. So it's not like we have a major inflation problem in this country. We don't. Headline inflation's higher at the moment, around 3, but that's largely because of oil prices and the home construction costs. But we don't have a inflation problem in Australia, and I doubt whether in wage negotiations at the moment, the higher rates of inflation are going to feed quickly through into higher rates of wage inflation. It's possible, but I think it's quite unlikely. The second part of your question was, could the unemployment rate go even lower? Again, it's possible. That would take us back to where we were in the 1960s, an unemployment rate starting with 3. If that were to happen, then I would expect that wages growth would pick up more quickly. But at the moment, I'm hoping we can get the unemployment rate down to 4% and see what happens there. But, you know, the scenario you're talking about is possible, but doesn't seem particularly likely at the moment.
But what is the reason you have not upgraded unemployment rate forecast? I mean, are you still expecting high fives for the unemployment rate?
When Delta hit, there was a lot of uncertainty about how the unemployment rate numbers would wash out, whether people would be recorded as unemployed or be recorded as leaving the labour force when they were stood down. And at least to date, most of the people who are no longer working are recorded as being out of the labour force, so the unemployment rate hasn't risen that much. Over the next couple of months, I think the unemployment rate will go a little higher as people come back into the labour force, but there's a lot of measurement uncertainty. So the unemployment rate, I think, is not going to go above 5% now, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did, if there was some quirk in the measurement of employment versus in the labor force. I think the other part of the question was, why is inflation picking up if unemployment isn't lower? It's largely due to these supply side issues that are affecting the price of imported goods and the very strong demand for residential construction at the moment is pushing up the cost of both domestic and global inputs. So it's these supply side things driving higher inflation. I think in time, as I said before, there'll be some normalisation of supply and demand for goods. And in time, I think we'll also see normalisation in supply and demand for residential construction as well. And that will take away some of these inflation pressures that people are worried about at the moment. I'm hoping that they will be replaced with some stronger upward pressure on wages.
Thank you.
Back to you.
The next question is from Stephen Halmarik from the Commonwealth Bank.
Hi, Governor. Thanks for doing this. Just back to the inflation forecasts. So with the benefit of watching other economies overseas open up, and we can see a fair amount of non-trivial inflation elsewhere around the world, and central banks seem to be responding to that. So what gives you comfort that we're not going to see that in Australia, or it's not going to be till 2023 that we might see that more persistent higher inflation? And my follow-up question would be, how does that feed into the bond purchase program? So you've got it going at $4 billion a week until February next year. So what's the decision-making process beyond that, whether to taper, extend, end the program come Feb?
On that second part of the question, I don't want to speculate on that at the moment. We've got these criteria we're going to use, what other central banks are doing, how our bond markets are functioning, and the progress we make towards our goals. So they're the questions we'll be asking ourselves. And we are making faster progress on inflation, so that would have logical implications, but I don't want to speculate on those yet. We'll decide those at our February meeting. The first part of the question was why inflation here isn't picking up as strongly as it is in some other countries. In the US at the moment, the employment cost index, which is their closest equivalent to our wage price index, is rising at nearly 5%. Our wage price index is rising at 2%. So there's something going on that's quite different in our labour markets. I think in the US, there has been a big fall in labour force participation. That's largely because of COVID. In the US, they weren't able to keep effective contact between employer and employee like we did in Australia through the JobKeeper program. So firms are keeping their workers attached to them. And in the US, the incidence of COVID's been much higher, so people have had to leave the labour force to look after others and because they were sick themselves. So when you put together JobKeeper and the lower incidence of COVID in Australia, that's helped keep labour force participation up, which gives us a different wage dynamics, and there are other structural factors that I've talked about on other occasions as well. I think one other difference between Australia and many other countries at the moment is what's going on with electricity and gas prices. In Europe, as you know, they're both going through the roof. In a number of other countries, that's the case as well. Utility prices in Australia over the past year have declined, not skyrocketed. We had big price rises in earlier years, but recently, price growth in utilities has been negative or very modest. And I think that's going to continue to be the case as well. So the labour market's different, and the energy complex is different, with the exception of oil, obviously. But both those things, I think, are a reasonable basis for us to expect that inflation will be lower here and not pick up as much. Now, having wages grow at sub 2 versus close to 5, it's quite different for the inflation outlook.
Thank you.
Okay.
The next question is from Michael Heath from Bloomberg. Over to you, Michael.
Hey, the question is for me, Swati.
Go ahead.
could you provide a timeline and some color into the board's decision to scrap the yield target? The context of my question is that the RBA decided to not buy bonds last week, whereas the actual board decision happened today. So how did that happen? How did the RBA dealing room
go back a couple of weeks when, in response to stronger inflation data around the world, all yield curves moved up, including here in Australia. and for a few days, the yield on the April 24 bond was close to 20 basis points. We stood out of the market for a couple of days as we waited for the market to kind of settle. And when it settled, it kind of in the high teens, as you know, we bought $1 billion of bonds and the yield came back towards 10 basis points, but didn't come all the way back. We then decided to wait a day and see what the CPI would deliver. And the CPI delivered, as you know, a higher than expected underlying inflation. And then internally within the bank, we faced the choice. Do we go, as I said in my prepared remarks, do we go and to defend the target, which we understood to be losing credibility for underlying reasons because we're making faster progress towards our goals? So do we go and try and defend that, or do we wait until the board meeting and get the board's views on the latest forecast and their implications for the yield target? We discussed that very extensively within the bank, and as you could always imagine, there are different views. And in the end, I decided that the better course was to wait and get the board's views on whether they wanted to continue with the target or to drop the target.
Was there an earlier meeting of the board last week?
No, there was not. As the governor of the bank, I have some discretion around issues like this. And I decided that the best course of action was to use that discretion and discuss it with the board today. And they agreed that was the right course of action. And I think one other consideration is, you know, we obviously discussed this a lot internally beforehand. If the board, we had an interim board meeting, phone hookup before today's meeting, then we would have had to make a statement about that, and making a statement before the regular meeting, you can imagine how that could go wrong. So we workshopped, I can assure you, every possibility, and after listening to all the arguments and working through with my colleagues, I made the decision to stand out of the market and to talk about it with the board today. And that didn't preclude the board deciding today they wanted to keep with the yield target. You know, I would have had a different communication message this afternoon if that's what we decided, but going into the meeting, that was a possibility. And we discussed the merits of that possibility today. And the board agreed that this was the right course of action, and they agreed with how the last few days were handled as well.
Okay, I just had a follow-up question as well. Could you have still bought the bonds to defend the target, because it was still your target until 2:30 p.m. today?
Yeah.
Could you have defended it and then decided today that, you know, we've had enough?
We could have, and you know, there was a reasonable argument to do that. We had this target, and you know, you could argue we should keep on buying the bonds until we had formally dropped it. There are a couple of considerations in not doing that. The first was that with yields having moved so much, the swap curve moving so much, and all other rates moving so much, it would have been difficult to achieve it. Yield of 10 basis points. In fact, I don't think it would have been achievable. So we would have been buying these bonds, buying all the freely floating stock and not achieving anything. So that didn't seem a sensible thing to do. And I think the other consideration was a communication one. If we had done that, then you would have rightly been asking today why we continued buying this bond, was ultimately unsuccessful, in the full knowledge that the distribution of risks are shifting away to make the target unsustainable. So, as I said before, I use the discretion that I have as governor to stand out of the market. We had stood out of the market on some previous occasions, not as dramatic as this one, okay, but I thought that was the best course of action.
Thank you.
Judy? Judy, do you, the next, but can't hear you. I'm having trouble hearing Judy, but Ricardo, I can see your hand up next.
G'day, Governor, if you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, so you go ahead.
Fantastic. I appreciate you making yourself available, but I think it caught many people off guard given the call details were at the end of the statement today. So why the hastily convened call, and can we expect this type of format more often or after each other meeting?
Why hastily? Well, we don't want to kind of announce a webinar in advance, because that would kind of provide a signal in itself about the decision. My strategy here is to have a media conference or a webinar when we're making important announcements. I don't think, at least at the moment, I don't see the benefit of doing this every month, because a lot of the time, hopefully, there's not very much to say and I give a lot of other public speeches. So my motivation is really to speak when I've got something important to say. We made an important decision today. I know it's a decision that's been the focus of a lot of media and market interest. And I thought it was appropriate that I explain what we had done, why we'd done it, and to answer your questions. So when we've got something important to say, then I would plan to do either a webinar or a media conference. But I feel like I've got to have something important to say rather than just speaking for the sake of speaking. You can hear too much from your central bank.
Ricardo, do you have a follow-up question?
No, very good. Appreciate it. Thank you, Governor.
Okay. The next question is from Phil O'Donohoe from Deutsche Bank. Phil?
Thank you very much, Governor, for your remarks today. I actually had a follow-up question to a recent question from Bloomberg, and that is in relation to your discretion around the yield curve target. I was wondering whether that discretion that you hold as governor also extends to the bond purchase program. And my second question is whether you can envisage another shock, probably needs to be of the same magnitude as COVID, but could you potentially see another shock down the track where the RBA would consider reintroducing a yield curve target? Or has the experience of the last week perhaps left to a bit of a strategic rethink about the usefulness or the effectiveness of trying to have a practical expression of forward guidance?
Discretion extending to the bond purchase program, it's not something that we've discussed at all with the board, and I don't see the need for any discretion. We're really locked into the current process. We'll talk about it at future board meetings, and there's no sense I have any discretion to make a change of direction there. I think if we were to change the direction ahead of February, there would be a special board meeting on that particular topic, but I don't want to think you that give you the impression that's even a remote possibility, because it isn't. We'll make a decision there in February and not before. In terms of the experience with the yield target, we'll have to evaluate that fully and as time goes by. It was very much a policy for a specific period in our history. I look back at the explanation I gave in March last year when we introduced that target, and part of the explanation at the time was that we wanted to directly target a yield curve rather than buying government securities, so doing quantitative easing. We elected at the time not to buy bonds, but to directly target the yield curve. I thought that was the right thing to do at the time. As time passed, other central banks were doing quantitative easing, and I thought we were paying a cost in financial markets for not doing that as well. So we went back and did the quantitative easing that we elected not to do in March. So I think putting all that experience together, it's quite unlikely that we would have a yield target again, not because of the experience of the past week, but it was a particularly unique set of circumstances. And at the time we elected not to do quantitative easing, well, that's now obviously changed, and we did that. So I don't think it's likely that we'll do this again, but you know, who knows? In January, I didn't think we'd be doing it. In January 2020, I didn't think we'd be doing it a couple of months later. So stuff can change, but it's pretty unlikely.
The next question is from Justin Favreau from Macquarie Bank.
Hi, Governor. Yeah, thanks for your remarks. It's very useful. I just want to ask a question about the global side of things here. We have monetary policy settings still in most places calibrated for a pandemic, and actually expectations that the macro outcomes will turn out to be much worse than they have. I think that's fair to say. So clearly central banks are starting to edge away from those settings. But, you know, in Australia, the RBA, and then you've got the Fed now placing a lot of emphasis on actual outcomes rather than forecasts. The RBNZ is sticking to the old way of doing things. You know, what's the risk here? You know, thinking maybe 18 months down the track, maybe it's a year down the track, that we have these extremely expansionary settings, you know, inflating asset prices across the board. You know, I know nothing keeps you up at night, but do you worry at some point that central banks globally, including us, have to play catch up here in terms of policy settings? And when we actually get to that point, the fact that asset prices are so high and might be even higher is a real risk in terms of what might happen when you start to tighten policy. Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, it's a remote possibility. I can't say it has zero probability of that scenario developing. What gives me confidence it's not going to kind of overrun us is that there's a lot of inertia in our labour market. Ultimately, we're only going to have an inflation problem if wages are growing much faster than 2.5% plus productivity growth. There's so much inertia in our system. We've got multi-year contracts. The award system only wages get reviewed once a year. There's this very strong cost control mentality in Australian business. That'll probably diminish over time, but it'll take time. So I think the likelihood of this getting on top of us is and finding ourselves with too high inflation is quite low. If we do find ourselves in a position where inflation picks up too quickly, we will raise interest rates to deal with that. And the fact that debt levels are quite high at the moment, it means that interest rate increases will be quite effective because people have more debt. So the cash flow channel is more effective when people have more debt. So no, not a zero probability event, but I think pretty low. And we would raise interest rates in that scenario. And I think that would be effective in slowing things down because of the high level of debt. Whether we get it right, who knows, but that's our general thinking.
We just have, we're running close to 5 p.m. We'll just take two more questioners, one from Alicia Barry from the ABC. Alicia?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Governor, for your time. Very quickly, on the yield curve control, would you say markets essentially forced you to drop the 0.1% target on the April 2024 bond, that you lost the battle there?
I wouldn't say that, and I just don't think about it as kind of a battle between the central bank and the markets. I know some people like to kind of dramatise it in that way, but I don't think of it in those terms at all. What financial markets are doing and what we did today was to respond to the better than or stronger than expected progress towards our goals. Now, it wasn't a battle between us and the market. I recognise that when we make faster progress towards our goals, then we have to change. And that's what we did today. And we didn't do it because of market pricing. We did it because it was the right thing to do and it was consistent with our framework. Sorry, it's not as kind of exciting as battle between the central bank and the market, but we thought this was the right thing to do. And we're making fast and expected progress towards our goals, and we responded to that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
And the last question will be from Wayne Cole from Reuters. Wayne.
Hi, can you hear me, Governor?
I can, yeah.
I can't get my camera on. When you do finish QE, I was wondering, what do you plan to do with all the bonds? You'll have hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds. Are you just going to keep rolling them over? You're going to let them mature at some point. What then do you do with the cash that you've created? All this hundreds of billions of dollars are going to be sitting on your balance sheet? Are they just going to stay there as cash? Are they going to invest them in something? Where's it going to go?
Well, our plan is to hold these bonds to maturity. So we'll have the bonds as the asset and the offsetting liability will be the settlement balances. And then as the bonds mature, the government would repay us and our balance sheet would shrink when the government repays us. So that is the plan. A number of other central banks are having to confront the issue of maturities and whether they continue to buy bonds in the face of maturities. We don't really have to face that issue for at least another year. It's an Australian yield curve, at least the early part of the yield curve. There are gaps of a year between the maturities. In some other countries, there are gaps of just a few months. So they're having to focus on reinvestment all the time, whereas we don't really have to focus on that issue for quite some time. And when the time comes, we'll make a judgment based on the state of the economy. But it's a perfectly sustainable situation for us to have a balance sheet with a lot of government bonds we hold to maturity, a lot of settlement balances, and on the date of maturity, the government pays us back the bonds and our balance sheet shrinks.
So that's
the base case, you know, stuff can happen, we'd need to change, but that's our base case.
So if you hold to maturity, that means you may face a paper loss on the bonds you're holding, given the move in yields, but you won't realise that loss.
Well, it really depends upon how quickly the cash rate goes up, or really the interest rate we pay on exchange settlement balances. Because we're buying these bonds and we're earning yields between 10 basis points and maybe 1.8%. So that's the running yield we're earning on those assets. And we'll earn that yield all the way down to maturity. At the moment, on the offsetting liabilities, we're paying zero.
Yes.
Because that's the rate on exchange settlement balances. So the running yield on these investments, if you think of it that way, is positive and will continue to be positive while ever the interest rate we pay on exchange settlement balances is less than the yield of purchase. Over time, if we're successful, then the cash rate will have to rise and the rate we pay on exchange settlement balances will rise as well. And then there'll be running losses, but we'll need to offset those against the running profits we're making at the moment. So we've thought a lot about this in terms of our capital framework. And if you had an opportunity to read the Reserve Bank's annual report, we lined our approach to capital there, and we'll continue to be very transparent about what we're doing.
Thank you.
This brings us to the end of the session. So I wanted to say thank you for everybody for attending, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Next Bye. Time.